I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, should America buy its chicken from China? But first to Washington, where some stories may reach a boiling point this week. Yesterday, Senator Arlen Specter said he thought Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez would resign ahead of a no-confidence vote pushed by some members of Congress. And lawmakers are also looking at the fine print in the proposed immigration legislation. Well, joining us for a Washington Week in Preview, John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and author of The Washington Wire for The Wall Street Journal. And John, first of all, what's the buzz? You know, the White House lost another major battle last week when Paul Wolfowitz resigned from the World Bank. Is there a feeling that Gonzalez is next?
Robin, Gonzalez just keeps getting weaker every day. It's pretty clear that his effectiveness as Attorney General has been almost completely undermined. The only question is whether the administration, specifically President Bush, decides it's more trouble to do without him and try to get a replacement confirmed in the U.S. Senate than just to hang on and leave him in the job for the last year and a half of the administration. Democrats are trying to pressure that process and move ahead with this no-confidence vote. Specter said over the weekend maybe Gonzalez would quit ahead of time. Very difficult to predict. I think most people around Washington, if you'd asked them a month ago, they'd say Gonzalez would have been gone by now. But as long as Bush wants to keep him around for whatever reason, he'll be around.
Well, something else happened recently. Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York and a sponsor of this no-confidence resolution against the Attorney General, says that he's going to look further into that damning testimony by former Deputy Attorney General James Comey. Now, Comey testified last week that when Alberto Gonzalez was White House counsel, he went to the hospital bedside of then-Attorney General John Ashcroft to pressure Ashcroft to renew the administration's warrantless wiretapping program. Ashcroft refused. But how much is that story of Alberto Gonzalez when he was White House counsel adding to his call, the call for his resignation now?
I got to tell you, Robin, that was one of the most shocking bits of narrative that I've ever heard in more than 20 years of covering Washington. The idea that Comey would feel it necessary to race over there to prevent Andy Card, then the White House Chief of Staff, and Alberto Gonzalez from obtaining the signature of a very ill John Ashcroft on an approval form for this program was really something. It stopped all of Washington. It made tremendous news coverage, and it simply added to Gonzalez's woes, although you've got to say that Gonzalez's woes were pretty bad before then, too. You have an increasing number of Republican senators, a half dozen or so far, many of those up for election next year, who say he ought to go. The question is how much more heat can be put on the administration to make a change. It's been remarkable that they've hung in so strongly so far.
Well, just quickly to this no-confidence vote that may come as soon as this week. The administration pointed out last week that they only have meeting in a parliamentary democracy. There's not much precedent for it. They're rare. Is it meaningful?
Look, there are a lot of votes in the Congress that don't result in legislation. It's meaningful to the extent that it stands as a mechanism to put senators on the record and put more pressure on the administration. It's not, it is not a customary procedure in the system that we have, but there are many symbolic votes that are cast, and this is another one of those.
Well, the Senate is also a beginning debate on the immigration plan that was announced last week, an improbable compromise between the White House and key congressional leaders, liberals, conservatives on board. But we understand lawmakers are now looking at the fine print. What are some of the concerns?
Well, you have concerns on the left and right. On the left, people representing Hispanic advocacy groups are complaining about the new prioritization for awarding new visas. That is to say, ranking skills above family ties in awarding those. They say that's an historic change in a policy that has rewarded family unification. On the right, you have so many voices on cable television and in the political system saying this is amnesty, this is rewarding lawbreaking. And from the sort of wallets of American business, they're saying, yeah, this may be a little bit better than what we have now, but it doesn't provide enough of the skilled workers that high-tech business especially needs to thrive in the 21st century. So what you have is a compromise that is very rickety, that nobody loves all that much and that a lot of people are shooting at. And we'll see if it can survive first the Senate and then negotiations for the House. Nancy Pelosi doesn't like it all that much either.
She's not happy about the tighter rules for family members.
Exactly.
Right. John Harwood, Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC, author of The Washington Wire for The Wall Street Journal, with a brief look at a couple things that are moving to the front burner this week in Washington. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, there's also a high-level Chinese delegation visiting Washington this week for the second session of the Strategic Economic Dialogue. These are the twice-a-year talks started last year by Washington and Beijing to resolve economic tensions. One of the topics that may come up, chickens. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is considering a proposal to let China sell chickens here in the U.S. Yes, the same China that sold a product contaminated with the chemical melamine to pet food makers. As a result of that, questions were raised about China's position in the U.S. food chain and its agricultural practices. Some farms in China, for instance, recycle human waste to grow food, and chicken coops are raised right over fish ponds, so chicken droppings feed fish. Well, we want to spend a few minutes today on these issues of food safety with Boston Globe reporter Dietra Henderson. Dietra, first of all, to China's plan. Americans eat a lot of chicken. China must really want that business.
China, as its number one goal, would like to open the U.S. domestic market for poultry, for its own poultry. Right now, a company in the U.S. can send poultry to China, get it processed, and have it shipped back here and sell it to consumers. That's already on the books. China wants to go one further and take their own domestically bred and slaughtered chicken and sell it here to the U.S. The way the law now stands, there would be no labels indicating to consumers what's Chinese, what's Canadian, what's U.S. chicken.
And what would be the problem with that? I mean, tell us more about how chickens are raised on some farms in China.
We know that the suspect ingredient that has triggered all of the massive recall of pet foods in the U.S. came from China. It was a rogue supplier. They added a chemical, an industrial chemical, and it's not clear whether Chinese chicken are routinely fed that chemical.
You say that some small plots, farmers may try to maximize their output by flooding produce with unapproved pesticides, pumping livestock with antibiotics that are banned here in this country, using human feces as fertilizer to boost soil productivity.
It's a fairly routine practice in some Southeast Asian countries. They even have a term for it. It's called night soil. On some, but certainly not all farms, there is an extreme view of recycling. Chinese chicken coops will be suspended over ponds, and in those ponds, they're growing catfish, tilapia, shrimp, all kinds of seafood U.S. consumers recognize and buy in their stores. The law tells them that that's Chinese seafood, but it doesn't say anything about the chicken. So the things that we take for granted about how produce is raised, about how poultry is raised, you can't take for granted in any other country, much less China.
Well, what does the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration, they share oversight on our foods, what do they say about protecting Americans from problems? I mean, it's not a done deal, so What are they saying about concerns?
This is one of those confusing areas because the FDA regulates 80% of the food that people eat, almost everything that goes on your table except for meat, poultry, and processed egg products is regulated by the FDA. This proposal comes under the USDA. But Rosa DeLauro, representative from Connecticut, who was opposed to this, says the USDA can actually streamline this rulemaking process anytime they see fit. And they really have a dual mission to promote U.S. produce and poultry and meat, as well as to maintain active markets for our products. There's a quid pro quo. China wants to send something here. We want to send something to China. What Representative DeLauro is saying is that USDA is wearing too many hats. You can't ask an organization that promotes U.S. produce and poultry and meat to make decisions about public health.
You point out that last month the FDA rejected 51 shipments of different kinds of fish from China because of contaminants.
The same contaminants that are being flooded onto these farms, the same unapproved antibiotics, the same hormones. We've got shrimp coming in tainted with salmonella. Salmonella is a known contaminant that's linked to poultry production.
So tell us more about the screening process. How does it work? What gets screened and what gets screened out?
The FDA will look at 1% to 5% of the imports. But some of these items coming in, they've had a bad history in the past. So they'll take a look at seafood coming in from China. And one out of every two inspections, according to some, comes up positive for these veterinary drugs and antibiotics. So they'll pour more resources in that direction. So we've seen a lot of rejections of Chinese imported seafood in the last few months because as they continue to make these inspections, they continue to get results that are troubling. In addition, we've got states taking a very active role. Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, at the prodding of local catfish producers, are taking a very, very close look at catfish coming in from China and are banning catfish from China because of these same contaminants.
Well, many states are taking a more active role in screening foods because they say the federal government isn't doing a good enough job. Former FDA Commissioner David Kessler says the food safety system is broken. You quote another former director of the Imports Division of the FDA saying it's a shipwreck. What's the criticism?
The criticism is that in a Republican-led administration that is a fan of small government, they are not giving the FDA enough resources to actively go out and deal with today's crisis and plan for tomorrow's crisis. If the FDA wants to do their best job, they've got to pull money from some other pot and something else goes undone.
In fact, Dietra, make the comparison between the budget of the FDA and the budget of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The FDA, as you said, 80% of the food Americans eat.
And 75% of the food safety budget goes to the USDA. The USDA has to have an inspector in every plant. There are 7,000 plants. The USDA has 7,600 inspectors. The FDA has to inspect 60,000 plants domestically. They have 600 inspectors.
Why is that?
If you talk to a Democrat, they say that the FDA is being starved, that there is a disconnect between what the people on the ground want to do to assure public safety and what the higher levels up to the White House wants to do to make sure that industry has a chance to thrive.
And again, the U.S. Department of Agriculture inspects, for instance, meat. Why would it be that there would be more inspection of meat as opposed to of lettuce, especially since, as you and others write, we understand that crop growers are crying out for more regulation.
Fresh produce manufacturers say that they want more regulation, and they're willing to pay for it. So a common thread to some of the discussion on the Hill is, okay, we need more money, but nobody wants to raise taxes. So Senator Clinton, Representative Dingell, and others have talked about user fees. A company wants to be inspected, they pay a fee. That money goes into a pot. The FDA gets to hire more inspectors. Senator Sessions out of Alabama wants more inspection of these seafood shipments coming in, the catfish that is competing with domestic catfish. So there is a will to put more money in the hands of the FDA. There's not a will to raise taxes to do so. The other reasons that they give is that there are these little fiefdoms. There are 12 to 15 agencies that have oversight over food safety, and each of them has their own sort of band of cheerleaders that does a very good job of making sure that their ongoing appropriations get funded and fully funded. I'm not certain why the USDA appears to have a better band of cheerleaders that is able to get the money, but if you look at some of these congressional committees, they're heavy with representatives and senators who are in the agriculture-producing states. Those people have to go home to their districts every year and answer to how this money is spent.
And there is a move to make just one agency to oversee these food issues, but as you write, there's maybe not a lot of support for that. That's Boston Globe reporter Dietra Henderson. We're going to have much more with Dietra after the break. And later in the program, another topic. Should radical environmental activists, eco-saboteurs they call themselves, who've admitted to acts of arson, be sentenced as terrorists? That's later as well. Back after a quick break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about food safety and the global food chain and China's role in that after pet food contaminated with the industrial chemical melamine was traced to China. Now the U.S. is considering a plea from China to sell its chicken here. What question does that raise about inspecting food imports? And here in the U.S., there was that tainted spinach. Produce growers have been begging the FDA for more domestic inspections. Well, joining us is Boston Globe reporter Dietra Henderson. And Dietra, you write that food safety is on the front burner right now. Isn't that one of the problems here, that people don't, you know, think about it until there is a headline? And overall, food is relatively safe.
Food is relatively safe, but some major things have happened. There have been major shifts. I just bought a salad that I put in the refrigerator. I'm going to take the lid off, and at lunchtime, I'm going to open up and eat it. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a fairly new concept, that I don't have to take my lettuce out, wash it. I don't have to cook the chicken to a certain temperature. It's ready to eat. Mm-hmm. And those products that go straight into the hands of consumers, if there's a problem, as there was with this washed spinach, it can become a national problem very quickly, affecting millions of people. The other thing that's changed is that the FDA used to go to each pier, each port, and they could do analysis right then and there. But this was before the era of container ships. Now we have shipments coming in massive supplies. Even if they do sample, and they sample more than 1%, how do you know that the sample is taken from a section of the container that's representative of the whole? And the FDA's food safety mission is one of its longest-standing missions. This comes back from the day when goods used to come into the U.S. in these barrels. They'd open up the barrel top. They'd look at the molasses. Are there bugs in it? They'd open up the flour. Are there things flying out of it? Today's contaminants include salmonella, E. coli, this industrial chemical that no one thought to test for.
Is it as simple as saying is that the FDA has just not kept up with the times?
The FDA hasn't had the budget to think about the future. They've only had enough money to deal with today's crisis. They careen from crisis to crisis with no time to think, to plan, to be logical, and to modernize.
Tell us more about the debate between new regulations and guidance. We understand from a recent hearing, you know, a mother whose daughter was made sick by contaminated spinach, which, you know, you might think, oh, well, how sick could someone get? This child's going to have a kidney transplant. And she said that the FDA had known about contamination issues for years, but just sent threatening letters to growers, never stepped in, never did anything in a more regulatory way. The current head of the FDA says regulations aren't the answer. They're too cumbersome. It's guidance that's important. Tell us more about that debate.
Well, it is true that regulation, whether it's letting Chinese chicken compete here or taking a more active role for the FDA, that guidance is a much faster way to make something happen than rulemaking. But there's also a role for an industry that is trying to regain trust that's been battered in all of these scandals. And that's a very powerful driver for change to happen. In fact, you take some of these fresh produce manufacturers who are clamoring for more regulation. They're working on their own to try to figure out ways to eliminate E. coli in their food systems so that this is less of a problem, less of a risk, and consumer trust rises.
Isn't that exactly, though, what the Bush administration is saying, that it should be on the marketing end?
It shouldn't be either or. It should be all parties, state, local, federal, on the regulatory side, and industry working together. And there are industry consultants who say that these producers absolutely have to know their suppliers. They have to know every part of that supply chain. If you can't get on a plane and go to China and see that farm where the manufacturing material is produced, you should not buy it.
That's on the company end. But what about, again, on the government end? We understand that agencies in the U.S. don't have the authority to inspect a plant in a country that makes food for export to the U.S. without that country's permission.
The FDA got tripped up on that point on the wheat gluten and the rice protein concentrate issue.
The ones that contaminated the pet food.
Exactly. They couldn't just jump on a plane. Number one, they needed a visa. The Chinese government had to issue it. And two, they needed to get access to facilities. They couldn't do that on their own. They had to go escorted by government officials in China. Don't forget that the FDA ran into this exact same problem when we had the flu vaccine shortage, and they wanted to go over to England and inspect Chiron's manufacturing facility. They didn't have the memorandum of agreement in place to make that happen quickly. So the FDA is saying that they're going to be working actively on these memorandums of understanding to make sure that if there's a problem in the future, that they don't have to go through this cumbersome process. It's like meeting the queen, and there's all this protocol that they have to follow. But they also have worked very cooperatively with the Chinese government and Chinese producers, talking about safer production methods, so that if you engineer quality at the beginning of the process, you don't have to try to inspect it out at the end.
Deidre Henderson, you're pretty immersed in this issue. You know, having heard from you, you know, reminding us that food inspection used to be you pull the lid off a wooden, you know, crate of pickles and test it at the port. And now with globalization, with high technology, that's a thing of the past. What do you see in the future? It almost feels as if this is a Pandora's box that, you know, it seems impossible to make sure that food is safe with some of the things you've described. What do you see in the future?
Well, I don't think that there's a choice because, as was mentioned at a recent congressional hearing, what this melamine situation has done is drawn a roadmap for a terrorist and the weaknesses in our food safety system. So there has to be an armor-coated food safety system. There has to be a more efficient and effective way of identifying current risk and future risk and tracing the problem back to the source. So I think that there's going to be a number of things. There'll be efforts by the industry to, again, get on top of this and move quickly, to define the message, to limit the scope of the problem, and talk about the future steps they're going to make to ensure that their consumers and their customers and their pets, pet owners, feel safe with the product that they're eating. I think that there are people who are saying that a monumental shift at the federal level will not happen unless there's a shift in the White House. Democrats are certainly saying that. There is a history and there's a precedent that was set when President Clinton was in office that E. coli in the Jack in the Box product was a national problem. They were going to devote resources and energy, and they came up with a plan. And years later, you see very, very few human illnesses based on that plan.
Dietra Henderson, reporter for the Boston Globe, talking about food safety. That's her beat. Dietra, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have the latest from Lebanon, which is seeing the worst fighting since that country's civil war. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, they call themselves eco-saboteurs, but are they also terrorists? That's a question before a federal judge in Oregon. And that's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A federal judge in Eugene, Oregon, will decide this week whether a group of 10 radical environmental activists and admitted arsonists should also be labeled terrorists when it comes to deciding their sentences. The defendants say the move is political, a way for the Bush administration to claim a victory in its war on terror. The prosecution says the label is justified because the 10 were targeting government policy. The 10 individuals, all of whom pled guilty to crimes committed between 1996 and 2001, acted on behalf of two radical environmental groups, the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. Tom Bonsi is regional correspondent for the Northwest Public Radio. He's based in Olympia, Washington, and he's been covering the story in Oregon. Tom, tell us a little more about the crimes. What were the targets and the methods?
It was quite an extensive crime spree, Robin, covering five western states, probably 20 arsons at least, or attempted arsons, and damage in excess of $40 million. It started with a couple ranger stations in 1996, apparent retaliation for logging controversies at the time, but went on to hit wild horse corrals by the Bureau of Land Management. Three timber company offices were burned to the ground. They hit some meatpacking plants. Chevrolet dealership, 35 Suburbans and Tahoes were torched, and the most costly was probably an attack on the Vail Ski Resort in Colorado, where there was controversy about expanding the ski terrain. It ended in 2001 with a spectacular fire at the University of Washington that was apparently motivated by opposition to genetic engineering of plants.
What would a terrorist label do? Would it change the sentencing?
It's actually very important. The defense, in part, is just they start out just being offended to be lumped in the same category as Osama bin Laden or Timothy McVeigh. But it matters. The sentence would get much longer if you're convicted of the federal crime of terrorism. In this case, as you mentioned, the defendants have pleaded guilty. So while their sentence will get very long to start, then it will be ratcheted back for cooperating with the government, but not all the way back to where they started. And there's a second element of being labeled as a terrorist in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. The defense also worries that these people will be thrown in some deep, dark dungeon as a consequence with the other terrorists. That government denies that it will happen, but there's a lot at stake.
Well, the prosecution is arguing that these people are no different than other terrorists. Tell us more about what the prosecution is saying.
Well, the prosecution is relying on a federal statute that comes after the Oklahoma City bombing, where society here in North America recognized there's such a thing as a domestic terrorist. And the elements of the crime were laid out by Karen Immigrant, the U.S. attorney for the state of Oregon.
The acts charged were planned and committed for the purpose of influencing and affecting the conduct of government, private business, and the civilian population through force, violence, sabotage, mass destruction, intimidation, and coercion, and to retaliate against the government and private business.
That's the prosecution. What is the defense saying?
The defense says the government is overreaching and that this prosecution is politically motivated. In the words of Lauren Regan, who's a legal defense nonprofit director in Eugene and former friend of the convicts, she says, you know, of the government, if they can't catch real terrorists, then bunny huggers will do.
What Congress intended by passing this enhancement is that it applied to people who killed humans or attempted to kill humans. That's the bottom line here. It never was intended to apply to acts of property damage, as in the case here.
Lauren's idea is that property damage and vandalism is not the same as the Oklahoma City bombing.
And we should be clear, nobody was killed or hurt in any of these attacks.
Right, and the defense makes that point again and again, that, as you heard Regan saying, there needs to be attacks that kill innocent people for this to be in the same category as other kinds of terrorism.
And of course, the prosecution saying it was just lucky that they didn't kill innocent people. Well, how important is this for the Alberto Gonzalez Justice Department? We remember when the defendants were indicted in January of 2006, he personally commented saying their goal was to try to influence the conduct of the government. Around the same time, John Lewis, who was Deputy Assistant Director of Counterterrorism for the FBI, testified to Congress that radical environmentalists were the country's number one domestic terrorist threat. And that led some to say, well, if so, why aren't more being arrested? And some to say further that that's what these arrests are about, to sort of back up that statement.
Right. Well, this is a very important prosecution for the U.S. government because this particular group, the ELF, ALF, has been very hard to penetrate. And in some ways, they behave like a terrorist group, organized into little cells that are not connected to each other, very few people. Lots of code words were used here. It was very difficult to penetrate. Mm. So the government's very proud of this. They want to make an example of this group. And if you send people away for, you know, 15 years, 10 years, or even longer, then maybe somebody will think twice about doing this again.
That's the government's thinking. Well, the judge, U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken, is making this decision tomorrow. She said it will be about, quote, applying statutes, not applying labels. What does the statute say? I mean, is there a one-line sentence that's being used to describe a terrorist?
Well, I would quote you, the assistant U.S. attorney, saying that defendant's conduct was aimed by force to frighten and coerce people to change their lawful conduct. And he says that is the essence of terrorism. Mm. And so the judge has a statute to work off of, but she can also look at the individual cases and motives of these people. So it's nobody here watching these arguments is about to make a prediction what the federal judge will do.
And in the meantime, the hearings have really raised a lot of interesting questions about just who is a terrorist, and acrimonious questions at times. The prosecution compared the tactics of these 10 to the KKK church fires in the South in the 60s. What was the defense response to that?
They were outraged by that. And the thinking is here that if you use the defense's argument that it can't be terrorist unless, you know, people are slaughtered, then the government counters, well, by that definition, the KKK was not terrorist when they snuck through the night burning black churches in Mississippi mm-hmm. and elsewhere that were empty. Or if a white supremacist did that, that wouldn't be terrorism. And the defense got, you know, quite bent out of shape when the KKK comparison was made because they said, well, yes, KKK did kill people. There were children killed in
yeah.
black churches.
Mm-hmm. And supporters of the defendants are also asking, well, why aren't people who bomb abortion providers, for instance, labeled as terrorists? So a lot of questions have been raised.
Right, and there have been something like 1,200 arsons and related sabotage attributed to the Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front, and no previous instance when they've caught these so-called elves has there been a terrorism enhancement sought, and so the defense wonders why now. Mm-hmm. But the government counters, well, yes, we have sought terrorism enhancements against people you haven't heard of before, such as in one case, a person who was sentenced for attempted arson at an abortion clinic, somebody who threw a Molotov cocktail through the city hall in a tiny town in Texas because he was mad at the police. It's not unprecedented.
Tom Bonsi, regional correspondent for Northwest Public Radio, speaking to us from Olympia, Washington, about an opinion expected to be handed down this week in Eugene, Oregon, deciding whether 10 environmental radical activist eco-saboteurs should also be labeled terrorists. Tom, thanks so much.
Pleasure to be with you.
And before we go today, the backstory of India's Taj Mahal. You're listening to Here and Now. Remember kickball? A mix of baseball, dodgeball, soccer. You kick a rubber ball, you try to reach base without getting tagged, thrown out, or hit with the ball. Remember it, you say. I'm playing it. John Kalish went to a park in Brooklyn where some 300 adults showed up for the start of a new kickball season.
It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and here in McCarran Park, a few blocks from what has come to be known as the hipster section of Williamsburg, Orthodox Jews are playing softball, some Mexicans are playing soccer, and a bunch of men and women in their 20s and 30s have gathered for the third season of an adult kickball league. The commissioner of the league is a 37-year-old event promoter named Kevin Daly. He stands with a microphone in his hand to officially, well, kick off the new season.
Welcome to Brooklyn Kickball 2007 season.
The adult kickball craze has been going for about 9 years now. WACA, the World Adult Kickball Association, says there are some 25,000 players in the United States. The Brooklyn League, which has close to 20 teams this year, has been basically doubling every new season since it started a few years ago. 23-year-old Jesse Sullivan was one of the original Brooklyn kickball players who used to hang out at a local dive called the Turkey's Nest.
So this started 3 years ago. It was about eight people that ended up hanging out at the Turkey's Nest. And now it's turned into like Price is Right, where everybody tries to be an individual and get noticed, you know? Hipsters really embrace the idea of irony. And I think there's something pretty ironic about a bunch of college grads playing an elementary school game.
This is the Wild Stallions, named after the band from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, versus the High Fives. They're in orange. And over here, you have the Bacon Bits versus Government Kickbacks. Is that right? They're new.
We play for the Never Ever Kick a Baby team.
That's the name?
Yeah. It's a new team name this year. Last year we were the Destroyers, but we're going to try to mix it up this year.
Another team in the Brooklyn Kickball League has a name that we won't say on the radio. There are female kickball players in these United States who do play topless. A kickball team in Milwaukee has been known to dress up as sausages. And to give you a sense of just how wild and crazy 21st century kickball can get, some games involve the use of a slip and slide instead of a base. You remember slip and slide, don't you?
Jay, go back!
Here in Brooklyn's McCarran Park, there was one team called the John Cougar Mellencamps.
It's a great joke. We've got these red, white, and blue gloves. We wear nothing but denim vests, denim cutoff jeans. The saying that a lot of our friends say is Sunday is the reason for living. The Sunday is just out of this world, especially in Williamsburg. Sunday is the most, like, it makes the whole week worth it.
That 24-year-old man is known as the Shirtless Wonder, a name that was written in large letters with a black magic marker on his naked back. The Shirtless Wonder divides his time between graduate school and teaching math at an inner-city high school. I met another kickball player who toils as a Wall Street trader, and this young woman, Bree Betts, who works at a scientific publishing house.
I like that it's not very competitive. You still get to run around a lot, but you can have cigarettes and, you know, go to the bar between games. And it's very casual, but you still run around a bit. So
kicking a ball really far or, like, into somebody's arms is a way to connect with that person, because it's like the ball and your foot is an extension of your limbs, and if you catch your ball, you're, like, hugging that person. And if you hit a home run, it's even more exciting because you're not out.
You got to admit, the man has a point there. The Brooklyn Adult Kickball League may be one of the few that actually plays at night under the lights. It has an annual awards dinner and a dance known as the Kickball. The league's page on the social networking website MySpace has 800 people registered as friends.
Who knew? Kickball is hugging a person. I thought it was torture. That's John Kalish reporting on the Brooklyn Adult Kickball League. Well, after a quick break, an attempt to reproduce heaven on earth created a hellish family fight over India's Taj Mahal. That's next, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Prophet Muhammad is said to have once described architecture as the most unprofitable thing that eats up the wealth of the believer. He might also have added, attempting to build heaven on earth is an act of hubris that may turn father against sons, sons against each other. That's the story of India's Taj Mahal. It was built by the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan between the years 1631 and 1654, a mausoleum for his beloved wife Mumtaz Mahal after she died giving birth to their 14th child. It's still one of the world's wonders, and now a new book looks at how the Taj is also the story of the beginning of the end of not only Shah Jahan, but the Mughal Empire itself.
It's a tale of overwhelming passion, set against a world of imperious patriarchs, jealous sons, and powerful, charismatic women dominating court politics from behind the silken screens of the harem. The fate of an empire of 100 million souls hung on the relationships within the imperial family, as sons sought to depose fathers, brother killed brother, and empresses and would-be empresses plotted and schemed. Yet a veil of glittering wealth, supreme power, and an exotic location cannot obscure the deeply personal nature of the emotions behind the Taj Mahal. At the heart of the Taj are questions transcending time and cultures about the nature of love, of grief, and of beauty, and of whether these intangible qualities can be given substantive and enduring earthly expression.
It's called Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire, and co-author Diana Preston joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Who were these two lovers behind the story of the Taj Mahal? Who were their ancestors, and set us in time with them?
The creator of the Taj Mahal was the Emperor Shah Jahan. He was a Mughal emperor in northern India, but he was descended from Genghis Khan and from Tamerlane. Mumtaz Mahal, the woman who inspired him to build the Taj, was in fact a Persian. Her grandfather had come to the Mughal court in India to seek his fortune.
They met when he was 16, she 14. They were betrothed, several years later married. She, as we said, bore him 14 children. It was quite a love affair.
It was one of the great love stories of history. If you look in the chronicles, you'll find tributes to her that are quite unprecedented. It really was absolutely a love match.
Because it was intimate, it was open, she was a part of his thinking. He seemed to treat her like an equal.
He did treat her like an equal, and even when he was in rebellion against his father and being hunted across India, leading a very precarious existence, she was by his side with their children. Even in conditions of extreme hardship and danger, she never deserted him.
Well, let's talk about this aspect, because thankfully for all of us, almost every actor in this stage play took notes. They all kept journals and they wrote down their thoughts, and you can quote them liberally. And through those journals, we learned that this was a dynasty drenched in jewels and gems and fine things. It was also soaked in opium and drenched in blood. There's a scene, page 54-55. I'm hoping that we can look at that now. It's one of many scenes like this when Shah Jahan's father went after his brother, his father's son, because his brother had tried to foment a coup. And they're captured. Would you do me a favor of reading what happens to those who were trying to fell the emperor? Again, this is Shah Jahan's father.
The emperor ordered his son's two supporters to be stitched tightly into the stinking and soaking wet skins of a freshly killed ass and ox. The men were mounted backward on donkeys, and this grotesque little cavalcade was led around in the baking sun until the man inside the ox skin suffocated, since, as the emperor noted with interest, the skin of an ox dries quicker than the skin of an ass. And also some of the other supporters were just spitted on pointed wooden stakes, some 300 of them. Just imagine this, a route lined with 300 shrieking victims. And the prince who'd rebelled against the emperor was led through this grotesque avenue.
And that's just one of the scenes of how hard it was to survive and how important to these people this kind of conquering was.
Exactly, because you have to bear in mind the roots that they'd come from, you know, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane. These were people who were used to fighting for a throne, and it didn't matter if your opponents were your brothers, your nephews, your cousins.
And with this in surely in the back of his mind, because Shah Jahan witnessed all of this as he was growing up, he ascends the throne, he becomes emperor, and as you said, he and his love, Mumtaz, then they start this traveling around the region to put down different conflicts in different areas. And it's on one of these trips that Mumtaz dies in childbirth. What does she say to her beloved, to Shah Jahan?
Well, according to the stories, as she expires, literally in Shah Jahan's arms, she whispers to him that she's seen in her dream a mausoleum that came from paradise. She wants him to recreate for her something similar on Earth.
Let's talk about the Taj Mahal. People might have a fixed image in their mind's eye of what it looks like, but what went into it?
It was a huge enterprise, because we all think of that shining white marble mausoleum, but that was only part of a huge complex. It's set in a walled garden with symmetrical buildings on either side, but building just the marble mausoleum itself was a massive enterprise. Think of carrying all that white marble hundreds of miles across India, of inlaying it with semi-precious jewels. You know, the Mughals really had a, if you like, a kind of fetish about jewels. Their own treasure is brimmed with pearls and rubies and diamonds. And for the Taj Mahal, they also brought rubies from Sri Lanka, they brought lapis lazuli, they brought malachite from Russia. You know, nothing was too good for the Taj.
And while he was building it, he made what most say was the fatal mistake of not paying attention to conquering.
But what happened was, you know, Shah Jahan's obsessive grief with Mumtaz, his preoccupation with building a mausoleum to commemorate her, meant that he just took his eye off the ball. You know, he of all people, considering the background history of the Mughals, should have known that his sons at a certain stage would start to jostle for power. But he paid no attention to this. He didn't see the bitter rivalry springing up within his family.
And he spent so much money on the Taj Mahal. Is there a way of calculating in today's dollars and cents how much it cost?
It's hard to be exact because the accounts themselves are not accurate, but we are talking about billions of pounds. People were worried about the effect this was having on the Mughal treasuries, which had once been so wealthy. So you begin to have economic decline and stagnation. You have the emperor no longer paying attention to what's happening on his borders, no longer fighting and pushing forward. And then, of course, you have this bitter rivalry breaking out within his family, rebellion against him. He just gets pushed aside, put into prison as his sons fight for the throne and murder each other, and one of them, the new emperor Aurangzeb, takes control.
At the very end, Shah Jahan, yes, he's imprisoned with a little window where he can see the Taj Mahal still. You go to the Taj Mahal. Now, knowing what you know, how do you see it?
I think I see it overwhelmingly as the product of a really deep, all-embracing emotion. He really did love Mumtaz. All of that love was poured into this wonderfully extravagant, emotional building that arouses so many emotions in the people who see it.
What happens when people see it?
You walk through the great sandstone gateway, and there, framed in the arch, is this wonderful mirage-like shimmering mausoleum at the far end of a garden with water channels and fountains and pools, and it makes everybody really catch their breath. It's a heart-stopping sight. It's absolutely unbelievable. And then when you walk through the gardens and into the mausoleum itself, and you look at Mumtaz's cenotaph beneath the dome, so tiny in comparison with this magnificent jewel-like building, it almost brings tears to your eyes.
Hmm. What was the best light to see the Taj Mahal in?
To me, it's most beautiful when you're there at dawn, and as the light begins to come up, you see this beautiful spectral image coming towards you. It seems to float. It's ethereal. All the beautiful melancholy of this building is captured in that moment.
Diana Preston with her husband Michael, they've authored the new book Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire. Thanks so much for telling us about it.
Oh, thank you so much, Robin.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.